You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Carrie Mayer, and she's the author of the novel The Kennedy Debutante, a novel about Kit Kennedy. She's the founder of Yarn, a journal of young adult fiction, and her new book is The Girl in White Gloves, a novel of Grace Kelly. Carrie Mayer, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me, Gary. I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, one of the problems a biographer faces, I think, is bringing their subject to life on the page. Now, I haven't read The Kennedy Debutante yet, but I just finished The Girl in White Gloves the other day, and I really enjoyed it. And in this novel, you really bring Grace Kelly to life by sort of dropping right inside of her.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. She was a great subject, and I felt privileged to be able to do it. And I had a lot of fun researching her and trying to get inside her head a little bit and imagine what it would have been like to make some of the decisions that she made and be in some of the situations that she was in.
I guess the frustrating part from a fan of biography is, you know, what what did you make up and what really happens?
Yeah, you know, writers of historical fiction get this question all the time at events and in interviews and things. And, you know, really the answer for every writer is a little bit different. I would say that one thing all historical novelists really try to do is account for any major toying with timelines or things that we might have done in our author's note. So, you know, it's a great tool for the historical novelist. Like, you know, I would never dream of, you know, changing any major dates in a character's or a timeline or the timeline of a major set of events, like a war or something like that. But every once in a while, for dramatic effect, it sort of makes sense to maybe switch around two minor dates in a character's life. I certainly did that in this book, not frequently, but once or twice, and I account for it. And, you know, the other thing that I needed to do in this book, because I covered such an incredibly long period of time, and because Grace Kelly knew so many people in her life, is I did create a few composite characters. I felt like that was a necessary thing I had to do, and something that, you know, other writers had done before me, so I felt confident in doing it.
Oh, well, is that important? I mean, you have to find precedent before you do things in a historical novel. I mean, when you're writing a novel and you're just kind of making it up as you go along, you can sit there and do whatever you want. But if this is someone's life, and I guess that's part of the historical novelist's bent, you have to be just, you know, I'm going to do this. But, you know, if you look at something like, Winds of War or something like that,
sure.
The main characters are all made up by Herman Wouk, and the people they meet are real. But in your case,
right,
pretty much everybody is real, right?
Yeah, really. I mean, pretty much everyone is real, except for, like I said, some of these are like composite characters. I used a real person's name, but, like, you know, it's actually a composite of different people that she would have had in her life. So it doesn't follow one person's life exactly. You know, in terms of precedent, that's a really interesting question. I mean, someone has to be the first to do everything. you know, I think that I'm not going to say that that a writer can't do something fresh and new and exciting. But I think that, you know, when we're asking ourselves, like, worry-making questions, it does, like, you know, should I, you know, if we're really wringing our hands about making a composite character or fiddling around with a couple of dates, it is heartening to know that, well, other well-known writers have done something before you. But that isn't to say that, you know, there are no hard and fast rules. You know, something that I've been returning to again and again were these lectures that Hilary Mantel, you know, of Wolf Hall, she has The Mirror and the Light that just came out. She did this lecture series for the BBC. And anyone can go and read them, Google them and read them. They're really terrific. And one of the things that she says about historical novels is that, you know, they are not exact replicas or photographic representations. They're more like a painting with the brushstrokes left in. you know, they really are a writer's interpretation of the events how they unfolded. I really love that as an image, and it's Hilary Mantel. So there we go.
Well, I don't want to give, you know, when you talk to novelists, you don't want to give things away in their novel. But of course, anybody that knows anything about Grace Kelly knows a lot of the things that happen.
Of course.
And that's another part of it. I mean, I read Barbara Leeming's book about Kit Kennedy. I know a little bit about her, but I don't know what she looked like exactly or what the sound of her voice was the way I know Grace Kelly. I know everything about Grace Kelly. So is it more of a challenge to write about somebody that is so well known in the sound of her voice, the look on her face, and so on?
You know, that's a great question. And again, I think some of it has to do with the disposition of the writer. I've done both, right? So with Kit Kennedy, I couldn't find any records of the way she sounded when she talked. I had to read representations of how, she sounded.
We can kind of assume, since there's a certain Kennedy sound.
Also, exactly that. But with Grace Kelly, you know, one of the things that I read about her is that she actually put in a lot of time when she was in drama school to sort of changing her voice for the stage to make it more sort of mid-century theater appropriate. I guess she was she had a little bit of a nasal twang and a sort of a little bit of a Philadelphia accent when she came on the scene as a young woman. I mean, she wasn't even quite 18 years old when she enrolled in the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. So her voice probably wasn't even fully formed yet. You know, it probably didn't have the adult sounds and depth that we hear it having in her movies. And so I thought that was, you know, you've read the book, and this is not a spoiler because it happens really early in the book, but I thought that was sort of an interesting thing to explore, was this idea that she had to change her voice in order to become the kind of actress that she wanted to be. And I actually saw that and knowing that she had a particular sound to her voice later in her life from her movies as a real gift to me as a writer in making her into a character. But on the other hand, with Kick, it was a sort of a gift to me not to know how she sounded. It gave me some freedom to write about her however I wanted. So it just, you know, it can work both ways.
I had a friend, she was a portrait painter, and she would paint portraits of various people. And somehow, all of her portraits, they were very good, and they looked like the person that she was doing, but they also looked a little bit like her.
Huh.
So what I'm wondering is, you know, when there are things that Grace Kelly is thinking and feeling, and she's a human being, and she's a female, and you're both of those things. So I wonder, is any of it you? Do you bleed in?
Well, you know, I think it's hard for writers to keep themselves out of their books entirely. And I think when we are writing about any character, whether it's an entirely made up, entirely fictional character or someone who was a real person like Kit Kennedy or Grace Kelly, it's important for writers to connect in some meaningful way with their characters. And so certainly I had points of connection, and deep, what I felt was like sort of deep understanding of what they were going through in particular moments. So for instance, both Kick and Grace were raised Catholic, and that's actually, it's very important for Kick. Obviously it's something on which the whole novel hinges. And in Grace Kelly's life, it wasn't quite that important, but it was still pretty important. And I was also raised Catholic, of a kind of Irish variety. So that was an insight I could bring to the creation of both of their characters. Now, when I was writing about their Catholicism, and this is where I think that the connection needs to sort of stay just a connection. When I was writing about Kick making important religious decisions in her life, or if I was writing about Grace behaving in ways that maybe her religion wouldn't have approved of, I had to ask myself, well, how would this have been for Kick? How would this have been for Grace? I would not bring my own feelings about Catholicism or my own experience into that. I needed to really look at, like, well, okay, so Kick was raised in this particular way and in particular set of circumstances and historical moments. How would this have affected her? And I asked the similar kinds of questions about Grace.
I guess one other thing I was thinking is, with Kick Kennedy, she died a long time ago, whereas Grace Kelly, I mean, I certainly remember the day that she died. So there are people alive and well who knew her. Her children are alive. Did you talk to those people, and have they read your book? Things like that.
I don't know. I was not able to speak to anybody that she was close to in her life. I mean, most of them have passed on. But I have to say, one of the best books that I read was by Judith Balaban Quine, who was one of her bridesmaids and a lifelong friend. And she was also about the same age as Grace, so they were really contemporaries. And she wrote a memoir called The Bridesmaids, about being a bridesmaid in Grace's wedding, but also about being a woman who was Grace's age, about her friendship with Grace, which really, you know, took many different forms throughout many decades. That was a hugely important book for me to read. It really gave me a lot of insight into what it was like to kind of live during Grace's times, and especially in the entertainment industry. The other book that I read, or I dipped in and out of, I didn't quite read it cover to cover, was Rita Gam, who Grace was good friends with her whole life and even shared an apartment on Sweetser Avenue in Los Angeles. She wrote a little memoir about, and the chapters are organized by other actresses and people in the business who she knew, and one of them was all about her relationship with Grace. And so that was also really useful for me.
We're talking Grace Kelly with Carrie Mayer, the author of The Girl in White Gloves, a novel of Grace Kelly. Let's listen to Grace Kelly and Bing Crosby singing the Cole Porter tune True Love from the film High Society.
Suntan, wind blown, honeymooners at last alone, feeling far above par.
Grace Kelly singing with Bing Crosby from the film High Society. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Carrie Mayer. She's the author of The Girl in White Gloves, a novel of Grace Kelly. So in Grace Kelly's life, she had affairs or alleged affairs. I mean, I've read Donald Spoto, has been on the show a few times, and I, of course, read his book and talked to him about Grace Kelly. And Randy Tarabarelli's been here, too. And they both have little cameos in your book.
They do. I read both of their books. They're excellent.
Yeah. And so there's been a lot of speculation about who Grace Kelly had affairs with and who she didn't. How did you decide who she did and who she didn't?
Well, so I want to qualify the word affair in this context. I definitely talk a lot or write quite a bit about her dating life before she gets married. But once she gets married, I really stick to exploring what I think the marriage itself was like. So I don't. So I'll leave it at that. So in terms of affairs, love affairs that she had before she got married, you know, that was sort of a. I had to. Again, Judith Books was helpful and influential to me on this point. And I read Donald's book. I read Randy Tarabarelli's book, among others. And what I felt like I had to do was kind of, read between the lines a little bit and make decisions about which relationship to portray to create a compelling narrative arc, you know. So I think probably her most important romantic relationship before marrying the prince was with Oleg Cassini, you know, the fashion designer who's actually much more famous for dressing Jackie Kennedy as a first lady. That was a really interesting relationship to explore, and that's a well-documented one. And so I had an interesting time going into that. The other ones I had to pick and choose, and I had to think about what form they realistically might have taken for Grace living in the time that she was living in. One of the things that Judith talks about in her book that I thought was so interesting was that, you know, women of her generation just did not talk about their sex lives or a lot of their most intimate romantic feelings. You know, those did you ever watch Sex and the City?
Sure.
So, you know, those great brunch scenes where they would do the download on Sunday noontime about their dates the night before, that just was not happening among Grace and her friends. So, and, you know, I think that Grace, like many women of her time, just she had experiences that she did not talk about. And a biographer really has to go by what people are willing to talk about. Whereas I think one of the freedoms that a novelist has that a biographer doesn't have is that we are free to imagine what might have happened. Because again, it's fiction. It's not, I'm not pretending that this is a biography.
Right. But I mean, you could have had her have an affair, on the set of Mogambo with Clark Gable if you wanted to, or even Ava Gardner if you wanted to. I mean, there's no, it's a novel.
Well, you mean to have her have Grace have an affair with Ava Gardner?
If you as the novelist wanted that to happen, you could have made it happen, right?
So that's an example of something I would not have felt comfortable doing, even if it would have created a suspenseful narrative arc, because there's literally nothing that I read that indicated that might have happened. Does that make sense? Whereas there was a lot of information that implied something unclear might have happened between her and Clark Gable, and actually that relationship is in the book, and I chose to portray it in a particular way. But like there's really nothing that suggests that she had that kind of a relationship with Ava Gardner, so I wouldn't feel comfortable putting that in. So that for me as a novelist, that's sort of a good example of where I might, that feels too fictional to me.
Yeah. But so you characterize her relationship with Gable in a certain way and her relationship with Bing Crosby in a certain way that maybe could have been portrayed in different ways. How did you decide?
Correct. That's for sure true. That is definitely true.
So how did you decide?
How did I decide? Well, so let's keep talking about the Clark Gable example. Because I did actually, between all the biographies that I read, and interviews and things, I felt like that one was sort of an interesting one. And one in which it really was unclear what had happened. So I just thought a lot about how old she was, how old he was, what the situation that they were in. They were on site in Africa. There seemed to be many corroborating sources that suggested that after they got back from Africa, Grace and Clark, that while they were in Africa, Grace and Clark, and indeed the whole company, everybody, Ava, and also Frank Sinatra was there because he was married to Ava and he was along for the ride. So I think it was like a really fun group of people who were on site filming in Africa. And they had a real camaraderie. But there seemed to be a real cooling of the camaraderie when they got back to London to do some studio filming. And that Grace was somehow saddened or disappointed by, the fact that she and Clark didn't seem to be as close as they once were. And there were a number of sources that said that. And so I just thought, so I wonder why that might have been and how that might have gone. And I wrote it with those questions in mind. I wrote the scenes that I wrote. But you're right. In another writer's hand, another writer could have taken that same kind of set of sources and come to a different conclusion that I did, or a different. Let's call it an interpretation. It's really an interpretation, not a conclusion at all.
Yeah, and I do want to say that one of my favorite scenes in the book is a scene where Clark Gable and Grace Kelly are alone and having an evening together, and it's just beautifully written. It's one of my favorites.
Thank you. Well, you know what? That is the scene that I read during my book live book talk.
Oh, that's a great scene.
So I'm glad you like it. I like it too.
I think Gable is an interesting character because I don't think, Clark Gable is anything like the actor, that we see on the screen.
Sure. No, I know. I think a lot of these golden age of Hollywood actors and actresses are real enigmas, and I think certainly Grace Kelly was. She had this reputation as an ingenue and an ice queen, and who was she really? And so it was fun to get to go there. But thinking about Clark Gable and Grace Kelly, this is a little bit of a side street, but I always think it's really interesting. He was 28 years older than she was, but of her, she only did 11 movies. And one of the things that people would say to me when I was writing, I would say, I'm writing about Grace Kelly. They would say to me, I loved her. I loved all her movies. Didn't she marry a prince? I said, I would say yes. And they would always say, wasn't he a lot older than she was? Referring to the prince. And I said, no, he wasn't.
He wasn't.
He was only 6 years older than she was. But the reason we think this about her is because her most famous leading men, and there were a number of them, were a quarter of a century or more older than she was. Gary Cooper in High Noon was 28 years older. Clark Gable, who you just were talking about, was 28 years older. Cary Grant in To Catch a Thief was, 26 years older. And so was Bing Crosby, who was her co-star in two movies. Jimmy Stewart was the spring chicken of the bunch at 21 years older than her in Rear Window. But, I just watched Rear Window. I did a live tweet with Heather Webb, who wrote Meet Me in Monaco. Even at 21, it's just really clear how much older he is than she is in the movie. And, it works. It's a great movie, and, we're rooting for them as a couple and everything. There's this tension between the Grace Kelly of the screen and who she was portrayed as and with, and the real life that she led.
And I guess that's part of the Hollywood double standard. I mean, we always see older actors with younger actresses. I mean, Vivian Leigh said that she didn't want to kiss Clark Gable because he had false teeth and bad breath.
I remember learning that a long time ago. Yes. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that it is definitely something that was common then and it is common now. We still see it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a school of thought that says that Grace Kelly left Hollywood when she left because it was time for her to leave. And if she had stayed, you know, her career might have dwindled anyway because she was getting a little bit older. I mean, she was like 26, right?
So, I know.
Yeah, like, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, Bette Davis and Joan Crawford are like the only two actresses who ever continued working after they were 40.
Yeah, well, she was a long way from 40. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if that was such a concern for her at 25, 26. I do think, and the book really explores this in more detail. So I don't want to go into it too much here, but this, it's also not really a spoiler. You know, at 25 years old, she was one of the oldest women she knew who was still not married and without a child yet. I mean, for her generation, that was old to be getting married. you know, most of the women in her that she knew and she grew up with were already married with at least one child by that age. So I think that was probably the greater pressure on her mind.
Again, I don't want to give too much away from your book, but since you talk about this almost in the first chapter, you don't think her marriage was a particularly happy one?
Well, that's complicated. I think her marriage was complicated, and I'm gonna leave it at that. I think that they're, you know, they had some really happy and, you know, times together, and they raised three beautiful children, and you know, certainly the prince never remarried, but it was complicated. She had to give up a lot to be Princess of Monaco.
I'll say, boy, I mean, you know, there are very few people in the history of Hollywood. There's Louise Rayner and there's Deanna Durbin and Garbo and Grace Kelly. Those are the people who walked away.
Yeah, well, now there's Meghan Markle.
Although she's possibly walking
she
back.
She seems to be inching, right, yeah, she seems to maybe be inching back. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough business, that is for sure. But, you know, something that I always like to point out about Grace Kelly and acting is that she, I think this is really important for people to understand, and something that, again, I really try to go to in the book, is that she never set out to be a Hollywood star, nor did she just fall into it because she was gorgeous and had some modicum of talent, right? Like, she went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and studied to be a stage actress in a really serious and meaningful way for years. I mean, she graduated from the Academy. She then also went on to study with Sanford Meisner. And, you know, she wanted to be a stage actress, a Broadway actress. And was actually disappointed again and again. She was in several, actually I think only two Broadway plays and a number of summer stock productions. But, you know, she went to Hollywood reluctantly. That wasn't where she planned to go. Which I think, you know, in some ways might have made it easier for her to give it up. But also, acting was a craft and an art to her that she had studied and honed and cherished her entire life. And I think to give it up, for anyone to give up a craft like that would be really hard. I mean, like, I think, you know, and that's another point of connection I had with her. It's like, so I'm not an actress, but writing is my craft and art. And I thought a lot about, you know, God, if I had to give that up, what would that be like?
Right. A painter or a writer can continue to do that even if they don't display their work or publish their work. But an actress has to be in an ensemble of some kind.
Yes. Yes. A performance.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're talking this week with Carrie Mayer. She's the author of The Girl in White Gloves, a novel of Grace Kelly. But, you know, one of the things in your novel, Carrie Mayer, the Girl in the White Gloves, a novel of Grace Kelly, you don't spend a whole lot of time on the set of her movies.
I guess I don't. You know, I was more interested in the interior drama, and about what the personal relationships were like between her and certain actors and directors, and what it felt like to do to be there. So right, I guess that's right. I don't spend a lot of time on the sets and in rehearsals. I tried to get more on the stage with her. Because again, that was what she was kind of trained to do.
What do you think her relationship with Alfred Hitchcock was like? I ask because Tippi Hedren was here on the show, and she wrote a book, and Hitchcock was fairly unkind to her and sexually harassed her, and she was kind of Grace Kelly's replacement in a way. She played
Molly.
What do you know about Grace Kelly's relationship with Hitchcock?
Well, you know, so Donald Spotto's writing was super helpful for me in this regard, because he's written extensively about Hitchcock, and I had the sense that his biography of Grace was sort of an outgrowth of his writing about Hitchcock, but I'm not sure if that's exactly right. But
I'm sure it is, yes.
Anyway, so I had a sense that it was actually a fairly playful relationship. Apparently one of the things I loved is in the book is that they traded like dirty Catholic jokes because Hitchcock himself was Catholic, or raised Catholic. I don't know if he was still a practicing Catholic. And so that was something that they had in common, and that they could, and it may have been in, Donald Spotto's, biography. I'm not 100% certain, and I don't have my notes in front of me, but I think it was him who said, that one of the great ice-breaking moments between her and Alfred Hitchcock was he told some dirty nun joke and she said, "Oh Hitch, I went to a Catholic school for girls. You'll have to try harder than that." And I just thought that was so revealing on so many levels, and so that moment makes an appearance in my novel. With a bit of a modification, that just says so much to me. The other thing that I read, I think in a few sources, was that Grace only did three movies with Hitchcock and then got out altogether. And I think that it's possible that some of the things that Tippi Hedren might have talked about and stuff that happened later, Grace got out before they could happen, or before it got uncomfortable. You know, I can't speak too much to the Alfred Hitchcock experience beyond that, because it seems genuinely mutually respectful and playful at times with Grace.
So let me ask you about your research, because you mentioned some of that, and you consider this historical fiction, and it is. How much research do you do when you're writing your historical novels?
Well, some of it depends just on how much is out there. As a little compare and contrast exercise, you know, when I was writing about Kathleen Kennedy, Kit Kennedy, there was a lot more primary source material available to me. So I happen to luckily live close to the John F. Kennedy Library in the Boston area. So I went and spent a day there basically going through all of their boxes of materials that they had pertaining to Kick, which included a diary, some scrapbooks, a bunch of letters. And I was able to, because this is their policy, essentially just take pictures of everything and upload them onto my computer and read them at my leisure later, which was terrific. And a lot of their material is also digitized. So I was able to, I also dipped in and out of their digital archive a number of times after that. With Grace Kelly, and then I also read a number of biographies and histories of the, you know, of the time period that I was writing about. In the case of Grace Kelly, I wrote to numerous historical societies, museums. I even tried, you know, I tried reaching a family member or two, but to no avail. I really could not lay my hands on very much primary source material from Grace, for Grace. The best that I came up with was at the Margaret Herrick Library out in Los Angeles. It's the library of the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences. And so they had some, they had a few good letters, like, between her and Cary Grant, and one particularly excellent one between her and Edith Head. And so, I had to rely more on, secondary source material for Grace Kelly. And how do I know I've done enough? When I feel really comfortable, that I have a command of the material, and sometimes that means I like if I come to like a third book or a fourth book or a fifth book, and I feel like even though it's written by a different writer, I'm reading the same material again. you know, it's not adding to my knowledge of the subject. That's one clue that I've done, probably enough. And another one is, scenes just start writing themselves in my head as I am reading the material. I begin, you know, I might, like, for instance, that episode that I think was in the Donald Spotto biography, I was able to read that and soon thereafter imagine a scene in which I could use that dynamic in an interesting way.
I loved it. I think it's a really marvelous book, and I want to ask you what... You went from Kit Kennedy to Grace Kelly, so I'm guessing that you're already doing your next one, or you're about to do another one. What are you going to do next?
I am writing a third novel, and it is about is not about royalty, unless you want to consider them literary royalty. I am writing about Sylvia Beach, the American woman who opened the original Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Paris in 1922. I'm sorry, in 1919. And who also, in 1922, published the very first edition of James Joyce's novel Ulysses after it had been convicted of obscenity and banned in New York in 1921.
Shakespeare and Company.
So it's in Paris in the 20s.
Shakespeare and Company makes a cameo in your Grace Kelly book.
It does. And in fact, you know, it's funny. that's a funny cutting room floor piece of trivia. When I wrote the very, very first draft of this, I wrote Shakespeare and Company, but then something, I thought maybe it might not have been, anyway, in some source they were like, it wasn't Shakespeare and Company, so I had to do some digging about the history of Shakespeare and Company. And the Shakespeare and Company that currently exists in Paris was opened by a man named George, I think it was Mistral, I can't remember his last name, George. And he opened it under a different name. It was called Le Mistral. And then after Sylvia Beach died, the real Sylvia Beach, he rechristened the book Shakespeare and Company, and so that is so the Shakespeare and Company that exists today is an homage to the original.
I've been there. I don't know if I've been to that one or the other original. When did Sylvia Beach die?
She died in the 50s. You definitely wouldn't have been to the original. The original was, well, unless you're older than you sound, but the original closed in 1941.
No, I'm 107, as a matter of fact.
No, you sound terrific.
I wasn't there in 1941. I think it was 1997. So obviously, it was the new one.
Yes. Yeah. Just about anyone who's been to Shakespeare and Company in living memory has been to the new one. It's a lovely place. It's absolutely lovely. And you know, if you look, there are many, many pieces of history and artifacts about the original one. They're not pretending to be the original. So it's a very special place in Paris.
So the fight for Ulysses will be a major part of your story.
Yes, the fight for Ulysses will be a major part of the story. That is a very interesting story.
Yeah, yeah. And timely, I believe.
I hope so. Well, it's timely in the sense that the centennial of Sylvia Beach's edition is coming up in 2022, and which is when my book is scheduled to come out.
Good timing. Tell me a little bit about Yarn.
Yarn, the Young Adult Review Network. I launched that with some like-minded friends and writers who also mostly happened to be teachers at the time.
You're an educator as well, we should say.
Yes, I haven't taught in several years, but at the time I was still a university writing professor. I taught mostly sort of freshman composition, but also some creative writing. So I launched it in 2010, and we were the very first, like, serious literary journal to publish fiction, poetry, and essays in the young adult genre.
And have you written anything in young adult genre yourself?
I have. In fact, I've written two unpublished young adult novels. One is a paranormal about a girl who could get into other people's dreams. And the other one was like a little contemporary novel about a girl who launches her own food truck. But I don't think either of them will ever see publication. So,
I don't know why not. I mean, now that you're, you know, famous.
I don't know about that. But many writers have novels in their attics that will never see the light of day, and I have five of those.
Oh, really? Now, do you have...
Yes.
And do you have stories rattle around in your head that you're... Is this a thing you're only going to do historical fiction, or do you think you will write novels, or will we see a lot of books from Carrie Mayer?
I hope you will see a lot of books from Carrie Mayer. I am super happy in historical fiction right now, which isn't to say that I won't ever write in another genre. I mean, you know, the five novels that are sitting in my attic, we'll say my attic, they're actually in like a variety of like floppy disks in some cases.
I would transfer
you know,
them.
I've tried my hand at a number of genres. I even wrote a romance novel one summer. And I think that was such an important part of my development as a writer, was to try my hand at different genres, to read those genres and see what they had to teach me. I also have an MFA in fiction. And MFAs really are very focused on literary fiction, which is terrific and necessary. But reading mysteries and romance novels and young adult novels definitely, I think, helped me get eventually to where I am now, which is historical fiction, which is definitely where I'm supposed to be. When I started researching the Kathleen Kennedy novel, you know, I hadn't done meaningful research in, you know, almost two decades. But it lit up parts of my brain that hadn't been lit up since college, and I just remembered how much I absolutely loved it. So I like the learning aspect of writing historical fiction as much as I enjoy the fiction part of historical fiction.
I want to also mention the cover of this book, Carrie Mayer, The Girl in the White Gloves, a novel of Grace Kelly. I can't imagine anybody looking at this cover and not wanting to read this book. It's a beautiful cover. How did you come up with this?
Well, I take absolutely no credit whatsoever, but I agree with you wholeheartedly. The wonderful art people in the Berkeley art department came up with the cover. I'm very lucky. They definitely ask for, before they come up with a cover, they ask for some input from me, if I have any ideas about what might make a good cover. And then they typically for these two books, they've come up with a draft or two and they ask for my input. So, I've been consulted, but I am in no way an artist and certainly in no way capable of coming up with something as gorgeous as this cover. So, and I'm thrilled to hear that you love it as much as I do.
I do. And I love the book, and it's called The Girl in White Gloves, a novel of Grace Kelly. And it's written by my guest, Carrie Mayer, who's also the author of The Kennedy Debutante. Carrie Mayer, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me, Gary. I can't wait to hear this go live.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.